Second Avenue, sick of dreaming, dreams that never come true. On a one-way street, and I know where it's leading to.
Hi, I'm Jamie Waxman, and this is the Hot Socks Podcast. If you are just tuning in for the first time, the Hot Socks Podcast is all about hot sex, sometimes, dating, relationships, being a single woman in her 30s, navigating what that means and wanting to have a baby, maybe. And this week, that's particularly of interest because I have a magnificent guest. I'm going to go right into it. I often go right into the interviews. You can find me, by the way, on Twitter and follow me at J-A-M-Y-E or on Facebook at J-A-M-Y-E Waxman. And that's with a capital Y and a capital X. And that, yes, is how my name was spelled at birth because my parents thought that it would be interesting once the nurse said that she thought it would be interesting to change the I to a Y. So it makes everything a little more confusing. That being said, we're back, and I'm really excited. In studio, and by in studio, I mean in my house today, I have a wonderful, fantastic visitor, guest, and writer named Rachel Kramer Bussell. I'm sure you have come across her online somewhere, whether or not it's erotic writing. She was recently featured in USA Today about 50 Shades of Grey and the resurgence or reemergence or maybe the popularity that never was that I think once was there of erotic writing. And she is also a world-renowned cupcake blogger. And I have to say, after being with Rachel for the last 2 days, she seriously, cupcakes is a big job. And she goes in search of the best cupcakes wherever she goes. And she has not let people in San Francisco down. I've learned about more cupcakes in the last 24 hours than I knew existed in the last 37 years of my life. So Rachel Kramer Bussell has not one, not two, but three books out right now. I don't even know. I'm going to ask her in a minute how many books she actually has out. You can follow her on Twitter at Rockalita.
Rockalita.
Rockalita. Okay, I said it right. R-A-Q-U-E-L-I-T-A.
That was my Spanish nickname in high school, in my Spanish class.
In your Spanish class. I was Juanita. But I'd always be like, yo soy Juanita, como esta? The books that are out right now that are fresh off the press are Curvy Girls. You can get that. You can get The Best Sex Writing 2012. Rachel edits these books. And Best Sex Writing has been a series for way many years with really, really impressive editors. And Rachel's is sharing a long line of a wonderful legacy. And Sweet Encounters is coming out soon.
That is what book of hotel sex.
A hotel stories, sex. We're going to have to talk about
hotel sex.
You love hotel sex? All right, we're going to talk about hotel sex and going down a book on oral sex stories. But Rachel, well, thank you, A, for doing the podcast with me and B, for being here. Yay!
I'm excited too. I feel a little bad because like I feel like I was like, yeah, like here's a laundry list of stuff, but it's become so, I don't know, this is just my life. I'm like constantly doing one book or doing
how many books do you have? How many books have you edited?
42, and by the end of this year there'll be 50.
Whoa!
I know, it's crazy.
Are you?
Because I do like 6 or 7 a year.
So are you the most prolific editor out there right now in terms of?
There's a couple others who do a lot. I mean, I think what happened is at the beginning, you know, I was doing maybe 1 or 2 a year, and then the process got easier. And I think it's an interesting process because I'll say to my publisher, let's do a book about, you know, oral sex or spanking, and I'll send a call out to the internet, and then people start sending me stories. And sometimes they send me a lot, like hundreds, and sometimes they send me dozens. But I'm usually juggling a couple of those at once. So I'll be checking those, you know, during the week and seeing who's sending me what. So I'm sort of always juggling a couple projects.
Now, I know you're an avid, voracious reader, but does it, like, I used to do voiceover writing for porns, mm-hmm. and after a while, it got really boring and difficult to.
Well, I try to space it out. Like, I won't read erotica for 3 hours in a row. I'll read, like, a couple stories at once. And in my personal life, like in my regular reading time, I really don't read a lot of erotica, even when I want to, because I write it too, and I don't want to get too confused. But I will read, you know, if it's something I'm super interested in. But in my recreational reading, I read cozy mysteries that are very silly but fun, and I read young adult, and I read other stuff that has nothing to do with sex, just because that's what I'm doing so much of it.
Do you read mostly fiction in your free time?
No, I read both. I read a lot of memoirs. Like, I'll read any memoir about almost anything. Like, even if it could be like, or I'll read a biography of a celebrity that I don't know anything about. Like, I read the Wendy Wasserstein biography.
Okay.
And I didn't know anything about her, had never seen any of her plays, but it was fascinating because it was about how she used real people in her life in her plays, and sometimes they would come see them and say, that was really recognizable. And she had a kid on her own at 48.
And she passed away a few years ago.
6 years later after she had the kid. But it was interesting to go in totally cold. Like, I knew nothing. I knew the names of some plays, but that was it. And I kind of like that sometimes because you just jump right in and you're like... Or Steve Jobs' biography, which I didn't think I was going to like because I'm not a techie. Like, I'm online all day. I'm on my iPhone, but I don't know the technical side of stuff. But that actually had a lot of art in it, you know, a lot of music and art and politics. And so I read whatever.
You must be great at a party because between, like, sex writing and everything else you've ever read, you can't never a dull moment.
I read a lot. Like, I read on the internet. I would say reading is probably the biggest impediment to my writing. Like, if it's late at night, I'm like, oh, I could write or I could just read this book. And, like, I'll usually choose reading the book. And it's interesting now because I work for myself and I have for the last 6 months. And I love writing, but sometimes I hate it, you know? And sometimes I'm just like... I have all these ideas and I wish I could just have the idea and like press a button and it would appear on the page because sometimes I love that process of just getting it on the page, but sometimes it's so frustrating when what you have in your head does not come out the right way on the page. So frustrating.
I think that's the most challenging. Like, I've taken months off from writing, especially in this last year where I just was like, I can't associate with writing for a little while. And then if I'm talking out a project or a writing project, it sounds great. When I put it down in paper, it's not my voice. That's the hardest thing, I think,
that
as a writer.
That to me is so frustrating because I'm good at ideas. Like, I'll get an idea for a short story or a title or a scenario. And I'm like, I know this would work with this particular theme. But when I sit down, sometimes I'll get like half of it. Like, I'll get a couple hundred words and I'm like, oh, this is going well. And then at the end, it's just not coming together. Like, I was trying to write for this lesbian sports erotica anthology, and I'm not a sports person. I'm not athletic.
I just love the particularity, lesbian sports.
There are. And so I had done this half marathon. I walked a half marathon in Seattle, and it was really fun because they blocked off all the streets and you're walking through the suburbs into Seattle and then down the highway. It was so cool. And actually, I was inspired by Runner's World, which I never thought I would like, but I was like, this is actually fairly interesting. It's not just about, you know, how to run faster. There was an article about sports fashion and sports dresses. So I started writing this story about this woman wearing this, not sexy, but bold, like hot pink sports dress, and everyone else is wearing really boring outfits, and this woman's checking her out. And I wrote about 2,000 words, which is almost the whole story. But then at the end, I couldn't figure it out, so it's still sitting on my computer. And that's when I get frustrated, because I know it was a good story and a good concept, and I was really proud of myself because I know nothing about sports, so I kind of used what little I learned in that marathon, like the scenario. And that's just, that kills me sometimes. So I don't know if it's that I should be at X time to X time every day sitting and forcing myself to like write something, or I should just, sometimes what I do is I'll have five things open in Word, and if one isn't working, I'll go to another one.
I think as I heard you say this, for me, I'm like, yeah, that would be a good idea to say from 9 to 11, you just write. But you know, I know I'm a morning creative. So for me, the mornings are the best time, but there are just some times like it doesn't click. Yeah. And then what do you do? How much of your writing?
I think there's something to the showing up every day. I mean, it's sort of harder when you have a haphazard schedule. But I was just reading Jill Dearman, who wrote this book, Bang the Keys. She has a blog, and she said, write 250 words a day. And she basically said, if you start with that premise, probably by the time you get to 250 words, you'll feel accomplished, but you'll want to keep going.
Because that's not even that much. It's like
a page.
And
it's funny, because in my head, my first thought was, that's nothing. Like, I'll never write a story like that. And then I thought, did I write 250 words yesterday? Did I write 250 words the day before? No. So if I had for the last 4 days, I would at least
have 1,000 words. How much of what you write is based on personal experience?
it's really hard to estimate. Like, at the very beginning, I've been writing erotica for about 12 years. Much of it was, or it was my fantasies. Like, my very first erotica story was called Monica and Me, and it was about Monica Lewinsky. So not true at all, but definitely my real fantasy about meeting her, and I was interested in her, and I had, again, I'd read her a memoir, so I worked with, like, little facts, like the lipstick she wore in her Barbara Walters special. But I would say, first of all, I mean, I've had some interesting sexual experiences, but I've pretty much run out of writing them word for word, like, even if I wanted to. So now it's usually, I'll take something that either happened to me or that happened to someone I know, and I'll morph it into other characters or other settings. Like, I'll take a setting that I've never been in, or like, one time, and I did write about this for Juicy. This really happened. I was stuck in the Atlanta airport.
And Juicy's a Jew magazine,
yeah,
J-E-W.
J-E-W-C-Y. I was stuck in the Atlanta airport overnight, and I met this guy, and we, like, gave each other hand jobs. And actually, people were really offended, but it was really kind of sweet.
People in the airport were offended?
Oh, no, no one was in the airport. Well, it was basically deserted. People who were commenting on it, they were like, that's really unsafe, that's disgusting. But it was actually kind of sweet, and he lived in Costa Rica, and it was his first time going to New York, and we were both stuck waiting for the next New York flight. And then he even, like, emailed me from Costa Rica and was like, you should come visit. Not like we weren't dating or anything, but in its way, it was kind of sweet. But so I wrote that, and I wrote it pretty much what happened in essay form. But then I kept thinking about that, and I've used that a similar scenario, like two people stuck at an airport, but totally different, in a different context, for an erotica story. And I think, like, taking the kernel of one thing and using it for something else, I like to do that. Like, there was a story about these two women who I tangentially know, like, who one stuck the other one for the check. And I kept, like, reading about this story, and I was kind of horrified by it. And then I turned it into an erotica story called Stranded, about a couple where this kinky couple, where the guy basically tells the woman, like, don't bring a purse, don't bring anything, just wear a sexy dress. So she's just in this dress. She has no, you know, phone or anything. And he says, oh, I got a business call, I have to go. And he leaves, and they've ordered all this food, and she has to work. I'm doing quote marks. She has to work it off in the kitchen with the chef. But it turns out it's all, like, prearranged, you know. So, like, he knows about it, and it's hot. Like, I like to take a real life scenario and that's not sexy and turn it into something sexy.
I have to ask, though, too, did you ever get to talk to Monica Lewinsky?
Okay, I didn't, but I met my ex-girlfriend via that story. Like, she came to a reading and was like, did you write this story, Monica and Me? And then we started dating, and then I forget how she knew about this, but Monica was at a Juicy party, and my ex went to that party and met her, and she also had dropped a letter off at the archive building where Monica used to live and told her about.
So your ex was kind of obsessed with Monica?
Also, yeah.
Okay.
So we were jointly obsessed with Monica. We used to
That's what brought you together. Monica Lewinsky brought you together.
And we used to joke about having a baby, and we would call her Baby Monica. Like, we would, yeah, we were kind of obsessed.
Why were you obsessed with Monica Lewinsky? What was it about her?
I was just fascinated by her. Like, I was attracted to her, but I also thought it'd be really cool to just hang out with her and chat with her. She seemed interesting. I thought it was very bold that she went after Bill Clinton in the way that she did. I mean, I know he went after her too, but I think that how many women, especially her age, in that situation, they might be attracted to him, but would they go to those lengths to pursue it?
Right.
With all the risk and all the, although I don't hear as much about her.
I was thinking about that the other day, like, what happened to her?
She's kind of off the radar. I know she had gone to the London School of Economics, and then last year there was a horrible story. Like, the tabloids were just like, oh, she's not over Bill Clinton, she's still single. And I think it's just part of that whole, like, women who are single, like, the media just wants to tell us all about how horrible it is, and then break it down. Like, if you're a black woman and you're single, that's, like, its own separate category of, oh, my God. And then if you're, like, in, you know, you're in your late 30s and you don't have a kid and you want kids. It's just, like, I don't know.
You're bringing up so many topics to talk about.
But I feel like, you know, it's like, if you're single and you're looking to meet someone, you already know all that. Like, you don't need the media to tell you, like, scary statistics and, like, make it worse. I think it's hard because I think we judge ourselves, too. I mean, I certainly judge myself. I would say I judge myself more than anyone else.
Well, I also think women dress for women. We don't really, like, guys, they'll notice things, but a guy more notices, and this is totally stereotyping, boobs, you know, ass, whatever. They're not like, oh, she's wearing, her nails are done, or oh, she's got this ring on, or wow, she's wearing a, I don't even know brand, but a Lululemon, Lululemon pants. Like, a few people would know that, but most guys wouldn't. I want to bring up two things because I want to go to this being single in our 30s thing, but a few weeks ago, I was on a panel on bisexuality, and like, I didn't actually know I was going to be on the panel at first. I just volunteered.
Where was it?
It was here at San Francisco State. It was with the Sexademic.
Okay.
I just thought, I wrote a paper on the bisexual agenda for my master's program. And you were just talking about being with your girlfriend who you met through Monica. And now I know that you're dating a cisgendered man. Do you define your sexuality?
It's funny. For a long time, I was like, I don't like bisexual because I feel like it's saying, bi. Like, I don't know. I feel like there are people who will say, you're mostly with guys, so you're not really bisexual. And I don't care. You know what I mean? I pretty much identify as bisexual, but I don't really, I'm not overly invested in that. Like, and I also think that it kind of assumes that, I mean, there's other parts of my sexuality that I think are more prevalent. Like, I would say I probably am more identify as kinky than I identify as bisexual. But
I
like,
talked to Clarice Thorne last week, and that was the same thing.
That's not in that at all. And I think there are plenty of people who, especially say it's kink that they're into, gender is less important. Like, if they're into a certain activity, I mean, that's not really me per se, but like, that is more important, like, than the gender of the person they're doing that with.
So when did you discover that you were kinky?
I would say, I forget when it was, but like, I don't remember exactly the first time I got spanked, but it was, I wrote this crazy story because crazy things used to happen to me in my 20s, and they still kind of do, like with that overnight thing, but this is kind of ties into bisexuality too. I had this crush on this woman who lived like four blocks away from me, and we became friends. We would hang out all the time. We'd go out drinking, but nothing ever really happened, but there was a lot of flirting. And then I met her landlord, who was this, like, Italian, Brooklyn, like, guy who's married, of course. And we would hang out and, like, kind of flirt. And then this one time, we were in my apartment, and his cousin was also there. We were all watching a movie, and me and the landlord were making out, and the cousin was sort of watching. And it was really weird. And I wrote an erotic story called Two Guys, a Girl, and a Porno Movie. And that was, like, speaking of using my experience, that was, like, 85% true. It was one of the weirdest things, because he was having the cousin wait in the car, and I was like, we're going to be a little while. That's weird. So then the cousin came up, but I just remember he spanked me. And I don't know if that was the first time. That was probably in something like 2004 or so. But I do remember that pretty specifically. Also, that was just ridiculous.
Well, I was trying to remember, I mean, you said you've been writing erotica for 12 years. And it's so funny because I remember, like, you and I were in New York at the same time, coming up at the same time in our sex education
careers. Do you remember
careers.
When we first met? Because I don't remember. I'm bad at that.
I'm not that bad at it, but I was trying to think of it. The only thing I can think of is at one of those parties. It was like a BDSM party that Tristan was throwing with Red at the time, and you were always working the door.
I used to do that. Yeah.
I don't remember what the party was. It called Submit.
Yeah.
And you worked the door, and I think that might have been the first time I saw you because I was working at Babeland at the time, and I came to one of them. But it's funny because our trajectories are. I mean, you really have, like, the market. I do feel like you're one of the best and really, like, top erotica writers and editors.
I think what's weird for me is, like, I remember so clearly when I was just breaking into that. I remember the very first reading I did, the very first erotica story I wrote and when it was published. And obviously a lot of time has passed, but sometimes, like, in my head, I'm like, oh, yeah. And then I'm like, oh, where did all these books come from? And, you know, it just seems like all that time has gone really quickly.
Do you have a favorite story?
I don't know. Like, my favorites change over time. But I think what's interesting, one of my friends who reads almost all my erotica and all my books, she sometimes I write under pseudonyms, and she's like, I can pick out your work. And that, she said it, I think, as a compliment, but I took it as like a challenge of, I don't want people to be able to pinpoint exactly what I, how I write. So I've tried to mix it up. But what I was going to say is I've written some humorous stories. I wrote one called Doing the Dishes that I read once in, say, 04, and people still remember it because it's about doing the dishes. And actually, it was inspired, we're in San Francisco, it was inspired by San Francisco. I was hooking up with someone who lived here, and I was visiting here, and they had dishes, all their dishes were dirty. Like, they were all in the sink and then spilling out of the sink, and I actually needed one to use. And they left, and I was at their apartment, and I washed all the dishes. And it was really, like, sexy to me because it was very intimate. You're in someone's kitchen, you're in someone's space, you're washing dishes
that they ate off of. You're seeing what they put in the body.
There is something, I think, intimate about that. Not turn on the way, it wasn't like I was like, oh, I must go masturbate after I wash the dishes, but there was something about that. And so I wrote that, and that's a funny story, but it really is about something that I think is intimate. But then I've written some darker, like darker pieces. I've written some breakup pieces that are pretty intense. So
are they cathartic when you write the breakup pieces?
Yeah. And it's funny because one about the Monica Lewinsky ex-girlfriend, and we're friends, but I call that story the end because it really was about this very dramatic ending of our relationship. And
I remember that relationship. I feel like I've known you for so many.
I think there is an erotic element to it, but it's not what I would call typical erotica because it is pretty dark of a story. But it's interesting because I called that story the end, but obviously in real life there is more. You know, real life is always going on. And that's one of the things I love about writing, whatever it is, fiction, nonfiction. I mean, you're capturing a moment in time and your own feelings at that moment, and you don't know how they're going to change in a month or a week or even an hour. So I think it's really important to write them down at that moment, because if you don't, you lose your train of thought and your feelings. And sometimes I say, oh, I shouldn't write that, because I just talk myself out of writing, whether because I want to protect someone or I don't like what I'm feeling. And usually those are the things I should be writing about. Like, I just wrote this piece, not about sex, but about binge eating. And I waited a little while, and I didn't wait too long, but I think if I had written it really freshly, it would have been even more raw, because it just happened, you know? So
do you think that the raw writing is really the strongest writing?
I mean, I think it can always be edited, but I think it's the most, I don't know strongest, but I think there's something to capturing it in the moment. And for me, that's always been, even before I started writing erotica or writing professionally, writing has always been the primary way I sorted out my thoughts about things. And when I'm having a really dark moment, or when something is just on my mind, that's the first thing I turn to. And when I don't turn to it, when I say to myself, don't write that because X, Y, or Z, that's usually, it just stays with me and sort of plagues me.
So it's almost like now, for it's me like too, when I hear don't write that, maybe it's really write that now.
And it doesn't mean you have to publish it or whatever. I just find that just the act of writing it down, it makes it all seem more okay, even if you're saying something that you're not proud of or you don't like. And it's hard because sometimes you're balancing what you're experiencing with what someone else is going through, and that tension is there. I mean, especially writing about sex, even when it's fiction. I mean, if I'm writing something based on someone I know, it is hard.
How does that work, too? I mean, think about it. Like, people go out with you, they know you're a writer. People with me, too, it's like, don't, when I date guys, I don't want you to write about me or something.
I think that's really hard to set that boundary, because I don't know what's going to happen. I never go into a relationship or date or anything like, oh, I'm going to write about this. Because first of all, I think that would lead to, unless you're doing journalism, like if you're at a party or an event, like that would lead to, or you're reviewing a toy or something. But I think it's not like I go into my relationships, I'm going to write about this. But if someone's part of my life, probably inevitably, I'm going to write about that. And, you know, I just wrote this piece about the guy I'm dating who's divorced. And I tried to focus it on my feelings and my interpretation of his being divorced. I didn't ask him. I wasn't like, tell me how your life has changed since you got divorced. Like, I didn't interview him, although I mean, you sort of are anyway, though,
in the sense that you're dating him. Like,
yeah, but I think I really try to keep it to my perspective, which I admit is always just my perspective. Someone else, the other person, might have a different perspective, and that's totally valid. And I think especially now, I mean, at the beginning, maybe it was different, but now I think if you're dating me, like, that kind of comes with the territory. It doesn't mean I don't respect people's, you know, boundaries. And, but I, you know, it's funny because several times people have said, well, as long as you don't use my name. And I'm like, why would I use your name? Like, it doesn't add anything to it. I would never say, oh, like, Joe Smith, blah, 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 like, did this thing. I also think even if they would allow me to do that, I don't need to do that to get my point across. It's not about, that's another thing. Yes, it's very personal and cathartic, but it's not necessarily about Rachel Kramer-Bussel or Joe Smith. I think it is ultimately about how that relates to someone else. Because, for instance, if I write about binge eating, usually people then are like, oh, well, I've done this and I've done this. Or when I wrote about, like, I'm a hoarder, all sorts of people told me, well, I'm either not a hoarder because my parents are hoarders, or because I, you know, want to go in the opposite direction and I'm a neat freak. I think people, you want to make it as universal as possible, but you can do that while being specific. But it's not about necessarily just, like, what that one person is going through. Hopefully it's about something larger.
So can I ask you, this is totally unsex-related.
Right? Yeah.
When you say I'm a hoarder and you admit it, does anything change after that? Do you just feel better after that? Like,
I think I felt better in that I just let go of that shame around it, because I would tell some people, and then a lot of people were like, oh, you're not really a hoarder because you're not as bad as X, Y, or Z. And I'm like, well, you don't really know. And it didn't change the specifics of it, but it just made me feel a little less awful about it. And it is something, part of why I wrote about it was because it is something I want to work on. I mean, I'm not ashamed of it, but I'm definitely not proud of it. And it actually does impede my life because I can't find things, or I break things, or things are not accessible. But at the same time, I think feeling all that shame, whether it's about hoarding or sex or whatever, like, I think shame is just so toxic because it's not helping you. It's not serving you. Usually, I mean, it makes it, it's so internal. Like,
yeah.
I don't think anyone else is, well, yes, I mean, people do judge other people, but I think we judge ourselves.
When I look at my friends and even myself, you know, when I look at my obstacles to success, I'm just blocking me. It's really me. Like, I'm the one putting up whatever. The way people see me sometimes and the way I see myself, you know, it doesn't always line up. And so I think, wow, it's me. That's my brain and whatever else. So, yeah. Why do you think 50 Shades of Grey is doing so well?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. For those who don't know, it's this erotic novel about bondage. And it's this romance where this younger woman, she's in college, is interviewing this older, slightly older billionaire guy. And then he's this dominant and he's wanting her to do all this kinky stuff. And she's never done any of this. And I really don't know. Like, one day someone was asking me about it, and it was in the New York Post, and the next day it's on the cover of Entertainment Weekly and at every bookstore everywhere. And, you know, I was talking to some publishing people about it, because the design of it, the cover is,
you know,
not,
I just bought it. I don't even know what's on the cover.
The cover is really not, it's not, I wouldn't want my book to look like that. I
mean, what
it's
is just that picture?
Not, it's like a tie. I mean, it's just not, it's not, I don't like that, the design. And I'm such a geek about books. I mean, I'll read a book if I don't like the cover, but I want to like the cover. Like, I go to bookstores and I will pick up the book with the pretty cover or the alluring title or whatever. So, you know, I don't know. It's weird because also it's being called mommy porn, as if only moms are reading it.
Well, it's weird. One of my college friends was like, suburban New Jersey mom, and was like, Jamie, you have to read this book, 50 Shades of Grey. If you don't know about it yet, all the moms are reading it when they're picking up their kids. And this was like 3 weeks before it made news everywhere. And I'm going to read it. I bought it, but I just don't understand.
Yeah. Well, and I started reading it, and to be honest, like, I started reading it, and I read romance. I love romance, but it just, I had trouble getting into it because I felt like the characters were these kind of stereotypical, like, she's so innocent and she doesn't know much about sex or the world or BDSM, which is okay. Like, I think that can work, but I think really the part where I got just not into the characters was he gives her this contract to sign, and some of it is sex stuff, and some is like, oh, you should be waxed or shaved. But then some of it is like, you should only eat from this prescribed list of foods that's in an appendix. And I just, and now I will give a caveat to that in 1 second, but I just thought, wow, like, I'm into being told what to do, ordered around, but like, that is too close to real life. Like, I just, and like, you have to, she has to go to a trainer 4 times a week. And also the language of it was so cold and clinical. It just, and it went on for pages. And I just thought, this is not about them interacting. I couldn't get into it. I will say there's a really great story that this woman, Elizabeth Caldwell, wrote called Lunch. It's in one of my books, and I will find out which one, one of my BDSM books. And it's about a couple, a kinky couple, where the guy tells the woman what to eat for lunch, and she's into it. But then the difference is she explained within the context of an erotic story why that was so attractive to the woman, like what turned her on about choosing this versus this. And there was this whole thing of like, well, he wouldn't know if I ate the other thing, but I would know. And it was her internal process. And I think that's really where I didn't, in 50 Shades of Grey, I felt like it was all him foisting this stuff onto her, and she kind of liked it, but I felt like she liked it reluctantly, and you didn't really get into why she liked it. And to me, that's, you need that. It can't just be someone's doing this to someone, and
so is that something that you look for as an editor when you have your stories, like in them, the person who's being submissive or done to?
And both sides. I think sometimes we only hear actually from the submissive, and I like to hear from both sides, because I think that's fascinating. And I think we don't, it's harder to explain sometimes, especially in the context of, well, fiction or nonfiction, like why you'd be turned on hurting someone versus being hurt within the context of consensual BDSM.
I think is what makes it so difficult with BDSM, is you hear pain and people think it can't be.
And then it's like, you can't say, oh, it's not painful. Like, it is painful, but within that context, that pain is exciting.
It's pleasure.
So, and I think that is really hard for people who, that's totally outside their experience, and they're not into that. I think it's really hard for them to say, but I don't understand, like, it's painful. And I think it, not everyone can do that well. Like, it is a skill to explain, whether it's the pain thing or the submission in terms of, like, letting someone control your life. Explaining that well is challenging. And in my opinion, E.L. James doesn't really do that. Granted, I haven't read the whole trilogy yet. So I've been seeing people say, well, if you're a suburban mom and, you know, your life is kind of in this pattern of being sort of beholden to your kids and having to do all this stuff, the idea that someone would be ordering you around and you'd be just having to, like, do what they say but in an erotic way is exciting, which I totally get. I just don't think that comes across for me in the books. Like, it didn't speak to that.
Well, it's,
and
interesting.
It's not like, you're right, like you said in the intro, it's not the first time we've had an erotic novel, so I don't know really why
that
took off right now, but it has, certainly.
But from what I hear you saying, I can understand, like, because it did for some reason reach this subset of culture that maybe hasn't admitted to reading erotica. Like, when I hear even you talking about your stories, not even the ones you just write, the ones you have, you and I have an interesting experience in life, because we spent our 20s single in New York, or dating, or in relationship, whatever, but in New York City as independent, sex-positive women. Yeah. And, you know, they say the average age of marriage has gone up for guys to, like, 28 or something. I don't know. But that's still very young to me. Yeah. And we've had all these experiences. So even when I hear you talking about, like, well, these are just experiences, most people don't relate to our experiences as normal. And what I see as normal is not, you know, so typical. So that it, I can then understand a little bit better where something this, sort of, this relationship might appeal to somebody who doesn't have that.
And I think it's interesting, like, when I was in high school, and I'm 36, so say 20 years ago, I read romance novels, but, and of different kinds, mostly contemporary. But now, if you go to the romance section, I mean, there's a lot of historical romances, which are, follow kind of a similar structure to each other, but the contemporary romances, there's all kinds of stuff. There's, like, kinky sex, bondage, threesomes. I mean, it's much less tame than I think people who don't read romances would realize. So I think this is part of this newish tradition of romance that pushes that envelope. And I think, you know, the books, The 50 Shades of Grey, tries to explain what that's all about, but I didn't get into it. And there's a part of me that, you know, I wouldn't say I'm a fan, but I think it's helped the industry. But there's like the personal part of me, and maybe this is a very female thing. I'm like, I wouldn't want someone to like say, I hate Rachel's books, so I don't want to say I hate 50 Shades of Grey. But whether you like it or not, I think the fact that it's on the cover of Entertainment Weekly, it got a $5 million movie deal. You go pretty much anywhere, and people who don't know anything about erotica are like, oh yeah, I read about that. You know, that my right. grandmother would have read about it in the New York Times. I think that is interesting in and of itself.
I think it's a wonderful awareness. It's a wonderful place to start talking about fantasy and what turns people yeah. on.
And I think it's definitely made the point, at least I hope it has, that you can be into this series or any kind of, say, bondage, reading about bondage. It doesn't mean you do it yourself. It doesn't mean you want to do it yourself. I think sometimes we don't differentiate between the kinds of fantasies that you have and enjoy as fantasy, and then the kinds of fantasies where you want to act them out. Those are two different things, and I'm all for like fantasy, dirty talk. Like, I think there's something about that where you have that space to think about those things, and you there isn't the pressure to do them. Because I think sometimes I've been in situations where I'll say something like in bed to someone, but then they take it literally. They're like, oh, let's do this. And I'm like, no, I didn't mean let's do this. I mean, in our fantasy world, let's do this, you know? Because sometimes when you take it into real life, it's not going to go as well as in your fantasy. Because in your fantasy, everything's awesome and amazing. And you can do all these crazy things. And in real life, like, there's sometimes issues. Or it just doesn't go as perfectly. And that can ruin the fantasy.
Right.
You know?
That's so true. Speaking of fantasy, you said you love hotel sex. I mean, I kind of think it's such a great thing because it takes you out of that headspace yeah. and puts you... What is it for you about hotel sex?
Well, first of all, I love hotels. Like, if I were rich, I would totally... I don't know if I'd live in a hotel, but I would totally stay in hotels all the time. I love hotels. There's something about just the anonymity and the, like, the plush bed and just... I don't know. It's just a fun place to explore. And I think there is something both... You know, you're in this private space, but also you can hear people through the walls, and you know people can hear you, and there's just things to explore. Like, they, you know, I don't know. I think that for me, like, I'm a little bit different in a hotel room than I am at home, because if you're in your home or your partner's home, that's surrounded by you or them, like
stuff.
Your stuff and your aura and your, it's just, it's all about the context of all these other things that are in the space. So in a hotel room, there it's totally blank. Like, you don't have to be whoever, you know, you're, I mean, you can turn off your phone. Like, it's just, there's no other reminders of anything else except the moment, you know, that you're there. So I think that is a large part of it. And I think it's exciting. Like, and also, I mean, I love traveling, but also the staycation where you just stay in a hotel in your own city, which I've done by myself, like, not in a sexual way.
Really?
Just to get it. Just because I, sometimes when my life gets super stressful, I'm like, I literally need an escape and I don't have time to go somewhere else. And it's kind of fun. But I've also done the staycation as a date, and that's really fun too, because you're in your city, and especially I live in New York, but I don't usually get to be like a tourist. And there's also the element of people watching. There's all this stuff going on in the hotel.
So like you sit in the lobby for a while?
Yeah, like you overhear tourists and other languages and you observe people. And I'm such a people watcher. I love trying to figure out what people are about. So there's all of that.
And so where was your favorite hotel?
There's this hotel in Minneapolis. Oh, goodness, I have to actually look up the title. It's this art hotel, and that's really cool because there's all this art all over the walls. My dream hotel is, I want to go to an ice hotel, even though I'm kind of scared, because I'm like, oh, that'd be so fun. And I've been wanting to write an erotica story, but I think it's
scary. But what if
scary.
You get stuck you in it? Like, what if
you
kiss
have to
the
be
wall?
You have to be in a sleeping bag and everything. but I'm fascinated. I didn't know about art hotels till maybe a year or two ago. And it's just something about the fact that it's temporary and that they can carve all this stuff out of ice into art. And just, to me, there's something really magical about that. And I would love...
Well, that's like pure fantasy, too.
Yeah,
like, who lives in an ice hotel?
I would love to go there with or without a date. And I just would love to, like, see that. But I have to say, I'm one of those people who likes to be warm. I love covers. I love warmth. So I don't know if my body would like it as much, but there's something about that that is just totally exotic. You wouldn't see that in your, unless you live in one of the few places where there are ice hotels, you wouldn't see that. Like, and I'll Google image search ice hotels and just like pour over the art because it's beautiful.
I'm gonna have to look.
And I think that would be a really fun vacation. Like, that's on my list of vacations I want.
Could do that probably in like Iceland, right, or somewhere.
Iceland, Montreal, and for some reason I want to say Romania, but I'm not sure. There's like three or four places, and actually I'm on a mailing list of one of them because. Also, there's something like in the moment, like, you know, you have to go between X time and X time because they don't have it all year round. There's just something fun about
ice melt.
And also the idea that everyone is going there for this specific thing. Whereas a regular hotel, there's people there on business and people there on whatever, you know, vacation. But there's a lot going on in a hotel.
Like, you're probably not going to do a lot of business in an ice hotel.
Unless
your business is ice.
I don't know.
Hotel.
But also, like, there's the hotel bar, there's the lobby, there's the room service. I don't know. Like, I'm always just, I think it'd be cool to work at a hotel. Just the fact that you get to see so many different kinds of people and deal with people. Probably it would be a pain in real life. Again, like, the fantasy versus reality, because people are, you know, treat customer service people really crappy. But still, I'm such a people person. It's funny, I'll be very a loner. Like, I just sometimes I'm like, I don't want to talk to anyone. I just want to like sit here and watch people. But I like watching people.
Yeah.
So I think hotels are perfect for that.
I had never really thought about going just to a hotel to observe, but I think it's a, like, the hotel bar is just full of like you said, a cross section, an intersection of life from you don't know where.
And it's interesting, even again, taking like real life experiences and turning them into erotica. I was at this hotel bar in Milwaukee, and if you're ever in Milwaukee, stay at the Intercontinental. Beautiful. There's art on the walls. Food was really good. And you can get to the theaters without even leaving the lobby. So I love knowing about like little things in different places. That's part of why I love traveling. It's just exciting. So I was eating at the hotel bar, dinner by myself, and I was reading a book, and I forget the exact line, but I'm pretty sure this guy said to me, "You must be really smart because you're reading." And I had no idea what to say because it was such a horrible line. Like, what was I supposed to say? Yes, I'm literate. And I was reading this book, Apron Anxiety by Alyssa Shalasky, that I highly recommend. It's this fun foodie single girl, well, it's dating memoir and cooking. And I just, so I wound up talking to him because I'm too nice. And like, he was just some guy from New Jersey who was there on business with his brother, but he was the one talking to me. And I could tell they were only there for one night, and I pretty much could tell that if I wanted to, you know, go back to his room with him, I could, but I so did not want to. And then my food came, like, or I had been eating my appetizer, and then my other food came, and I was trying to, you know, I was like, how can I talk to this guy and eat? And really, I just wanted to read my book. So I'm writing a story about basically that happening, but then a couple who are kind of on the prowl for a third person who swoop in and, like, rescue the me character from this, like, sleazy guy.
I'm still trying to think what you can. Wow, you're really involved because you can talk. Like, what could you say back?
I mean, what I just, and I realized, like, really, that's the best you can do. And usually I will give guys credit for, like, coming up with a line, but that was such a bad line. I was like, well, I love being at a hotel bar. If I had been in my room, this would not have happened. Because I do think there's something to being in public, whether you're, like, I often write in coffee shops, and I love it, and sometimes I meet really cool people, but sometimes you're at the mercy of, you know, someone might be like, oh, you know, they just want to talk to you about whatever, and it's really hard to just say, I can't talk, like, it sounds...
It sounds rude, it's hard to not...
To my ears, it sounds rude to say.
Yeah, I understand that.
Keep working.
So you talked about that you were reading a memoir about a single girl, and we have, you know, we have had now 48 hours together in the same home, and we are similar in age and in places, and we've both talked about what it's like to be a single 30-something female in a city or wherever today, and I think. Like, I'm struggling with some writing right now around wanting to have a family and not wanting to be single and being okay with not wanting to be single as opposed to feeling like I have to feel okay being single and then like, well, if anything happens. Do you feel like, do you get a lot of, like, it's not feedback's not the word, but When you say to people, like, I want a family, and they're single or not single, do you get, like, oh, you should be happy where you are all the time? Like,
you know what I get the most? What's your plan? Like, basically, how are you going to have a kid on your own if you don't...
Now, would you have a kid on your own?
I think I would, but it's much easier to say that in my, you know, oh, yeah, I would. I don't know how exactly that would work out. But people are like, what's your plan? And I'm like, my plan is to pay off my student loans and, like, not be so... You know, it's like... I'm right now, you know, I'm doing well, but I don't have that financial safety net. So I'm like, the idea of having kids, like, I can't really entertain that right this second. So I'm like more in the moment trying to figure all that out. But at the same time, I know that it's not like I have forever to have kids. And I've been wanting to since I was 30. But that is the main thing I get. Oh, well, you could either just adopt or just do it on your own. People are like, you should look up one of your exes and just be like, oh, would you sleep with me and then we'll have kids? I'm like, I don't know that most of my exes would be up for just fathering my child and then walking away.
It's funny, actually. That's because people have said to me, well, you can go do this. Like, I have, since I was 32, 33, really gotten that bug of, I would like to have a baby, and now, you know, it's a few years later and I don't have the relationship in place and all the other stuff. I have two partners from my past partners who have said that they would father my children.
And then be out of the picture. Or be semi in the picture.
Yeah, I know, that's the thing, is like this is all weird to me because I grew up in this very traditional, conservative, Jewish Long Island family. My parents have been married over 40 years. Like, I just knew the stability. You have two parents, you have siblings. Now, obviously, that's not most of the world, but...
Especially now.
Especially now.
I think when we were growing up, that was more prominent, and now there's so many more options.
So,
and
right.
Socially acceptable options.
So, I never really thought about these other options. Now, honestly, like, I would like to have a child, but I also know I would not do it alone.
Yeah.
Although there's no guarantee once you have a kid if you're doing it alone. And then people are like, well, then you don't really want it that bad if you wouldn't do it alone. And it's like, no, I know how difficult it is.
And I also think it's interesting because there's so much pressure on women, especially, to want to have kids. I have plenty of friends who don't want to have kids at all. And I think it's still seen, even though it's 2012, that's still seen as somehow, oh, but you really want to, you just don't know, or like it's gonna hit you whenever. And it's like the idea that everyone should be a parent, or especially every woman should be a mom, is kind of disturbing because it's both a lot of work, and I don't think it's something to take lightly. Like, I don't think that's good for the kids or good for society if people are just having kids because of social pressure. That doesn't make sense to me.
No, and the truth is, for me, like, I mean, yes, physically, probably 10 years ago would have been awesome. I mean, although I feel like I'm in a great place, in a great shape, but emotionally, mentally, I know a lot more about what I would bring on my child now than I did 10 years ago. And, you know, I don't think parents really understand when they have children what... Even the subconscious stuff that they do is, like, going to impact our futures.
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like right now is the perfect time. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm in this, in this pivotal place where it's, like, I want the grounding and stability. And I need to, like, start focusing on if I'm going to have a baby. I only do have a few more years. Yeah. And then that's that pressure of, well, is it worth it? Will I regret?
Yeah. I think also that pressure just... For me, when I start to feel that pressure, it's usually like I bring it on myself. That's so, I feel so overwhelming. I just cannot even function. So I much more try to like focus on what I have to do right this second. And in the past year or two, I've been trying to get my life into a better place, both financially and emotionally, just so that I can even think about it. And I actually decided last year, I was like, I'm going to take 2012 off from thinking about kids because it's too much. Like, I'm getting so stressed out about it that I can't do all my other stuff. So I'm like, let me see. I'll assess at the end of this year. Like, I'll be 37 in November. I'm like, let me assess. And then 2013 is when I'll really work on it. Like, I would love to be, I feel like I'm going to jinx something if I say this, but like, I would love to be on my way to having a child by the end of 2013.
I also found it was very hard to navigate. When do you tell somebody that this is an important part of what you're planning for your future? Like, I was bad and I would tell people on the first date, like, do you want to be a dad? And I'm like, woo, that's too soon. But when is the right
time? But I also feel like, at least in my experience, for men, it's much more, oh yeah, like down the road, but they'll be, you know, 35, 40 down the road. We can't really say, oh, in 4 or 5 years. I mean, first of all, I really want to. You know, if I won the lottery, I'd be like, okay, I'm getting pregnant. who, I don't care how. Like, it's not, I don't think it's just a money thing, but literally, if I won the lottery today, I would be working on having a kid, like, right away. So, I don't know.
You would screw your whole 2012 plan.
And I would. But I don't, you know, it's funny because I just started dating someone and then I'm like, oh, that's not awkward because they might be listening to this. But I'm pretty sure we haven't had, like, the talk about, are we going to, you know, do all that? Because that's a lot of pressure on a relationship.
But he knows you want children.
Yeah, I mean, but that's a lot of pressure on a relationship. So I haven't said, you know, in 2013, I want to have kids. But my basic feeling is, like, I do. And if it's with him, that's great. And if it's not, I'll find some other, I think I would want to find some other way to do it.
Like, my fear is that I could settle in a relationship because of the timing of also wanting to have a kid. And I, like, I'm really right now trying to formulate how to get a strong support network around just even the idea of having children with other women. Because I think we can be our best friends and our worst enemies. But
I mean, I'm happy that I know single moms. I have cousins who have kids who live near me and, you know, are doing it, in some with partners, some, you know, friends without. And I think that when I do have kids, there will be people available to me to, like, help me just navigate all of that. And I mean, it's scary. I say I want to have kids, but I worry all the time. Okay, I'm neurotic. As my kid, am I going to pass on my neuroses to my kid? Am I going to be a good mom? Am I going to be too this, too that? And it's just like, that's when my head, that's why I had to take off the 2012. So I was like, I need to get my life in order and my emotional and, like, physical life in order, and just, you know,
but I really think too, are you ever, like, people are always like, you're like, you're never ready, but it happens when it happens. And
who knows? Like, I don't know. I've never tried to get pregnant. So I don't, and I've never been pregnant. So, like, I don't know if even,
that's my freak out too. I've never been pregnant.
And how do you, I mean, you can't just,
I haven't always been safe.
Test it out. Yeah. So I don't know.
So I know that's, and the other part of it is, if you get pregnant, it's a crapshoot. You have no idea what's going to happen.
Also, like, I don't know what that, you know, for your health. Like, it's not an optimal thing for your health.
Right.
But I, like, when I hold babies or when I hang out with kids, like, whether it's my cousins or my I have friends with kids, and I love hanging out with them. They're so fun. There's something so, like, my friend's daughter, she's 2.5, and I would go visit, and I'm happy to see my friend, but I really liked hanging out with her daughter. We had our own friendship, and, like, I love that. Like, it's so, to me, like, the process of watching them go from being babies where they don't talk and can't really do much to, like, being little people who, like, talk and know stuff and are smart. Like, they know so much, especially when they're, like, 2 or 3. You're like, you're so tiny, but you know all these words and things. And I was hanging out with my cousin, and we were playing games online, and I went to this site, abcmouse.com, because I looked up, like, games online, and literally he was like, .com, .com, and I just thought, dude, you're 2.5, how do you know that says .com? It's so cute.
It's kind of scary that that's what he knows, too.
It is.
But that's where we are right now. But no, I think for me, children, like, allow me to be the creative, imaginative side of myself that adults try and say you have to grow up. And as a writer, I mean, you're always creating and fantasy, so it's obviously different fantasies, but being with a child allows you to explore a creative, imaginative side.
And I also think there's just something there, the control freak part of me, I think, needs that, like, letting go of, you can't be a control freak totally. Like, there's parts of it that their personality that I think that just is part of them, and it's separate from you. No matter how much you want your values to be their values or whatever, like, they're their own person. And to me, that part is fascinating, that, that, like, there's a part where you just can't overthink it. It's like, well, what if, you know, they get my this trait or that trait? Like, you can't, I don't know. And so, I don't know. So I have no idea, but, like, I know that it's something that if I don't get to have kids or be a mom in some way, like, I will feel incomplete.
That's how I really, like, if I look back at my childhood, I realize, like, one of the things I always wanted to be was a mom and do it my way. And I do feel like I might be incomplete, but I also feel like there are options, like, I could adopt. And I feel also like I'm working on both sides. Like, if it didn't happen, I'm working on how to take care of myself too. It's just hard. I think I would love to continue, like, in our personal lives, this conversation, just support each other over the next year or two. But I also would just like to say to people out there who are like, oh, bitch, moan, or, well, you don't know how hard it is or whatever. We only know our own life experiences, right? So it's like, wherever we're at right now is where we're at, and I've said that before, but it's lonely being, I mean, you were talking, there's a huge movement on the soloism, why people are alone a lot longer, and, you know, I've had a great run of being alone. I just...
It's funny, because there came to a point where I realized I actually want to have a kid, kids, more than I want to be in a relationship, and, I mean, I love the relationship I'm in right now. I do like being in relationships, but I'm very independent, not a loner necessarily, but I definitely need alone time. Like, I would not want to be with someone literally all the time, because I would go crazy and I would start to resent them. So I really do like having time on my own.
You're such a Scorpio.
Once I realized that, well, like that actually, if I had to prioritize, like, I would be happy. I mean, I would be okay being single. I mean, not never going out on dates or having sex, but just being single and having a kid. I would be happier doing that, I think, ultimately, than I would be being in a relationship and not having kids. But who knows? Like, and I feel like, I don't know. And I also think, like you kind of just said, I am never trying to speak for other people. Like, I don't know what other people should do. And I think it's totally, I don't like the way that we try to force marriage and motherhood onto women. Like, I think that's fucked up.
It's so, and you know, it's really
damaging, because then people start to think, oh, is there something wrong with me? I mean, people will say, like, you know, why don't you have kids? Or why, people say to, I have several friends. I have a friend who has two kids with her partner of 10 years. And it's like, why aren't you married? I mean, who cares?
Who cares?
Why do you care?
It's, and the interesting thing, and this is not mine, but my friends, Ian and Alicia, Freddie and Eddie, we were talking about marriage the other day. And, you know, marriages these days are based on this concept of love, not so much ownership or property, which they used to be based on. And love is such a volatile emotion to be basing anything on.
On the other hand, like, I don't really plan to get married. I mean, never say never, but I wrote this piece about that, touching on that, and someone said to me, well, like, think about, you know, tax breaks, and, like, even if you don't want to be, and I just thought,
well, that's why I think I'd get married, health insurance and taxes, it's a business thing.
I don't know, there's something about the romantic side of me that I can't, I'm not, like, super sappy, but I am, there's something about that, and then there's the other part of me that is like, well, why would I deny myself, like, saving money? I don't know.
It's,
but that's also why I think it's kind of messed up. Like, I don't think we should privilege marriage over other kinds of relationships.
No, well, it's the same thing. It's,
I
like,
mean, I mean, I think the idea that there are tax breaks for that means that we're saying marriage is better. And I mean, I think it's pretty clear, like, to anyone that marriage is not necessarily better.
No.
For some people it is, but as a whole, with our divorce rate and just shitty marriages all over, how can you say marriage is always better?
I think if for my 40th birthday, wherever I'm at, like, I'd like to do a registry and just get people to buy me the gifts that I would have gotten if I had had that wedding.
Also, like, the stuff that you buy people on their wedding registry is often, like, really? Like, I don't want, like, a crystal bowl.
No.
I want, like, a dress or something, or shoes. I'm like, you know, that's like if I ever do
it. Or money
for a
house.
Like, buy me, like, you know, sex toys, or buy me, like, a tattoo or whatever. I don't know. I'm going to register.
No, a crystal bowl, really. When would you ever use it?
I think there should be an alternative registry, both alternatives to marriage, but also, like, wedding registries for, like, cool shit that you actually want. Vacation, or, like,
I think we have a new business.
Alcohol, if that's your thing, or whatever. Like, I would rather have, like, a pound of fucking coffee than a crystal bowl.
Oh my God, this hour has flown by. So, Rachel, you have
could make that. That could be our alternative business.
I think that we might have to. Your website right now, though, is lustylady.blogspot.com.
Yes.
You also have rachelkramerbustle.com.
Yeah.
But really, Lusty Lady is where you update the most when it comes to sex writing. And, of course, cupcakes take the cake.
blogspot.com.
What's your favorite cupcake in the world?
Oh my God, s'mores. There's a couple s'mores that I love. S'mores, chocolate mint, and chocolate peanut butter.
But check out the cupcake blog. I mean, that is food food porn at its best. You can find Rachel on Twitter at Raquelita, and that's Raquelita. Where else can people, are you?
That's
the best place to find you.
Yeah, Twitter, I update all the time.
And you can find her all over the country, really, traveling at any point. You can find me at jamiewaxman.com or at JAMYE. This has been so much fun. There's so much more. Like, last night we're talking, and I'm like, we can't talk about this now. We have to talk about it tomorrow on the podcast, but I don't even remember what that was. And now you'll have to just come back next time and stay with me, and we'll do more. Until next time, this is the Hot Socks Podcast. Thank you for listening. What is your favorite erotica? Oh, and I think Rachel has submissions for some erotica up on her site.
Do.
You do, right?
Yes.
So you can submit your own stories and be your own erotic rock star. Thank you for listening. Talk again soon. Bye.
Started to flow.